Hello, my spooky friends.
And welcome in to I'd Survive. My name is Cassie.
And I'm Caitlin.
I pitched this podcast to Caitlin about a month and a half ago, I would say. And this specific idea for a podcast has been something on my mind probably since around September 2024. I knew that I wanted to do it. I really wanted to get it going in 2025. Caitlin was the first person that came to mind because we're both like reaction girlies on YouTube. We both love horror and we kind of created a friendship over on Twitch where we stream. And so I was like, hey, do you want to do this? And I've got an official pitch. The way I was pitching this to you, it was almost like it came across like I didn't want you to do it because I just didn't want to put pressure on you. I was like, you don't have to do this.
That's kind of true. She's like every other sentence is like, but don't worry if you don't want to. Like, it's totally fine. And I was like, no, that actually sounds so sick. I'm so down.
She's like, Cassie, I want to do this. Like, stop.
I really had to be like, no, girl, listen, this is a great idea. And I'm so here for this.
Yeah. So basically, this is a horror movie recap podcast. It's going to be a little bit heavier on comedy than serious review most of the time.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. But we're both such horror girlies that having a horror podcast is like a dream. We wanted to talk about how we both got into horror. So you go first. Tell me.
First? Okay. So no, for me, the funny thing is I grew up hating all scary stuff. No interest in horror movies. Like, I nearly had a panic attack when I found out that ghost hunters were like a real thing, that actually hunted ghosts. And the reason it threw me off is because the Taps building was about 10 minutes from my house. Like, I saw it all the time. And I was like, why does that building exist, Mom? What? Like, I thought that was just a show. She's like, oh, that's like the real ghost hunters. And I was like,
oh, no, what do you mean?
And it horrified me. So that was like my childhood, was being terrified. And then I went to college and my friends decided they were going to have a horror movie night. And I was like, okay, I'm not going to be the one person that doesn't go because I'm too scared. So I went and I was like, wait, that was kind of fun. And then we watched a few more and I realized how much I like that feeling of being scared, the adrenaline of like being super scared and having that feeling in your body, but also knowing you're perfectly safe. That was back in 2015. And ever since, I've loved my spooks, but I still have way too many films to learn about or hear about. Both classics and moderns. So I'm very excited for this.
Yeah, that's what's really cool about like becoming a horror fan later on, because now you have so much to catch up on.
I really do.
My story's a little different.
All right, lay it on me.
My dad had me watching Scream when I was 4 years old.
Ooh, four.
And it was actually really, really bad. I remember he wasn't forcing me to watch it, but they had it on and I was in the living room. And it was the scene where it's the opening scene and Casey's looking out the front door and into the night and you think something's about to happen. And I was traumatized, like terrified. I had nightmares for a year, like recurring nightmares.
Oh, baby Cassie.
Sleeping in my mom's room, hoping that her then boyfriend, now my stepdad, would stay overnight because I felt more safe and I knew that Ghostface wasn't going to come murder me.
Wow. Four might be a little young.
It was just a little. Way, way too young. So then from there, I was like the creepy kid who like enjoyed shows like Courage the Cowardly Dog. And I loved Coraline, like all of these like kid movies that have that creep factor that turn a lot of kids off.
Right.
I was like, this is my shit. So that was me in childhood. And then I would say around 10, 11 is when I was like going for it with horror movies every other weekend. It's really actually fond memories of like going by my dad's every other weekend, and he would always take me to Family Video. We would get like five or six movies, and me and my cousins would just watch movies all day long.
That's classic.
We all loved horror, so it was like pretty much a horror marathon.
Amazing.
I've loved horror ever since. Now we want to get into like our top five favorite horror movies. Ironic, my number one is Scream, the one that traumatized me as a child. There's got to be something psychological there as to why I love horror so much and love that movie so much.
It got you into horror, something you ended up loving. So it's like you gotta have like a special connection to Scream.
Yeah. I will say overall, my favorite like horror genres, I probably lean toward psychological horror thriller vibes. Like I love
psychological.
Yes. It's my number one favorite genre instilled in horror. So Scream, I would say there's definitely psychological aspects to that,
oh, yeah.
Even though it gets pretty classic slasher.
It is classic slasher, but you're also, your brain the whole time is like, well, is it you? Or is that what you want me to think? Do you want me to think it's that person? Could it be that easy? That's like the whole Scream journey.
Exactly. There's like a manipulation factor on the audience and like you're in your own psyche and trying to read their psyches. It's so good. As far as my remaining top five horror movies, I'd say number two has to be Get Out.
Ooh, okay.
I think it's so eerie and so well done. And I love, like, I do actually really like, it can be a hit or miss, like, social messaging in movies in general and horror. It has to be done so well, but I feel like it was done a perfect amount in that movie. And the performances are just crazy.
It's interesting for me. I've seen that one, but I don't remember it at all because it was a long time ago and we weren't really paying attention. So I need to rewatch that one.
Yes, you do. It's so good. I still haven't seen, because obviously that's Jordan Peele. I have seen Us as well.
Yep, I've
I have
seen
not
that.
Seen Nope yet.
Same.
My number three is Psycho, which is the movie that we're going to be talking about today. I'm so excited to tell you the craziness that goes on in this movie.
I'm so excited. I can't wait. Like, this is one of those ones where people are like, how have you not seen this?
Yes. Number four is Speak No Evil, which is actually going to be our number two episode.
Ayo.
I just don't have the patience to like wait. Like, if you haven't seen one of my top five movies, it's going to be in these earlier episodes because I need to tell you.
So fair.
And then number five is Barbarian.
Oh, good one. That's a good one. That's a movie that does some flips that you don't expect.
Yes, I love when a horror movie can get you unexpectedly emotional. So go for it. What are your top five?
Okay, I feel like mine are like so predictable, but it's fine. My number one is The Conjuring. And what I think is interesting about this is The Conjuring was the first movie I did for She's Scared. So like yours was Scream, which was like your first introduction. And Conjuring for me was like, it's like a really vital
yeah.
one for
there's
my
a level of nostalgia factor.
Exactly. And I just, I don't know, I personally, we were talking about psychological, I love paranormal horror. I love just spooky ghosts and haunted whatever. It's just, that's my genre. So for me it's Conjuring, and then my number two is Scream.
Nice.
Most importantly the original, but I also love two, but the original, nothing can beat it, nothing ever will.
Nope.
Number three is Midsommar.
Oh, yeah.
That one I hated when I first watched it. And then it stuck with me for so long. And now I think about it probably once a week. You know, it's like my Roman Empire is yeah. Midsommar.
No, that's amazing. I love that movie.
My number four is, and this might be a little bit of recency bias, but I put down The Substance. Because
valid.
This is another movie that I think about all the time. Like, that's like a big indicator for me on whether I like something or not. It's like, how often do I go back and think about it? And The Substance is one of those films that just sticks with you. And again, like you were saying, the social messaging in it, very interesting in this one. So
yeah, so well done.
So good. And then number five is probably my most controversial, is The Strangers.
I think I love.
Yes. I think it's such a good film. So many people hate it, but that it's such a raw film in the way that it's just an intruder in your house and you don't know they're there. And then it's so creepy. It's such an unsettling concept. So
yes, I totally agree. I love that you are a big lover of paranormal horror because I enjoy it, but it doesn't scare me. So
ooh.
Like what really scares me is humans. I'm like so scared of people, and a lot of the times, like even just commentary on men specifically, I love men, no hate to men. I don't want to get in trouble on our first episode.
Not on the first episode.
But like, you know, statistically the history of like violence, men against women, and just feeling helpless as a woman, just like strength factor wise, like yeah, if I'm alone in my house and there's a man outside toying with me, what am I going to do? Like, that's terrifying. Yeah,
that is.
But then, like, something will happen and I'll be like, oh, I think my ghost is around today. Like, in my house, like, something will fall and I'll be like, it's fine. My house might be a little bit haunted, like, just a little, but they're nice ghosts.
Wait, so can we just, like, we're not going to go deep into this for a sec, but I have to ask, yeah. Do you believe in ghosts?
So I think I do. I'm not sure if I believe in demons.
Ooh, fascinating.
In the way that they're portrayed in horror, I just... That's something where I'd have to see it to believe it, but I do believe in, like, spirits.
Ooh, okay, I love that. I'm kind of on the same page. I'm very much like, maybe, maybe not. I don't know. I think they probably exist, but maybe they don't. I don't know.
Yeah.
We could have a very long conversation about that.
Oh, yeah. We'll get into it eventually with, like, paranormal movies, too. Okay, so yeah, this podcast, it's called I'd Survive for a Reason. At the end of each episode, or I guess each recap that we tell each other, we're going to each assign a survivability score. And that is what you're seeing in the title of this one. It is our combined average of survivability score for this movie, Psycho. How likely we think it is for us to survive it. If we give it 100%, that means we're like, oh, I got this, no problem. I'm going to survive this so easily. And then 0% means, oh, we're 100% dead. Like, there's no way I could make it through this movie. I'm just going to say, I'm not going to act like this is like me naturally talking to you guys. I literally wrote out like a little blurb of what to expect from this podcast. And I'm just going to read it to you to introduce you to what is going to happen here. This is a horror movie recap podcast. One of us will be covering a horror movie every week that the other hasn't seen. So one of us will be the storyteller. Today, I'm the storyteller for Psycho. And the other will be reacting in real time to the plot of the movie. There will be some review elements that come naturally when we talk about a movie. But our main objective is to have fun telling each other what happened in the movie, play some What Would You Do along the way, and give it a final survivability score. The types of horror movies we want to cover are all over the place. We're down to cover the more modern, buzzworthy movies, but I'm also very excited to discover foreign horror films, older horror, and indie horror, so that the stories we tell may also be brand new for your ears as well.
Slay.
Now we get to like the really fun part where I get to start talking about Psycho.
I'm excited.
Going into it, you have seen Bates Motel.
I have.
Tell us like what you remember from that show. It's interesting because I haven't seen Bates Motel. You might make connections as I'm telling the story, like to the show where I'm like, oh, that's interesting. But yeah, what do you remember?
So I'm the kind of person who watches a show and then immediately forgets everything that happened in the show. So
yes, that's what you were saying before about like what it takes to be a top five horror film for us is like just being able to remember a horror plot is a big deal.
Exactly. So with Bates Motel, I remember there was a young guy named Norman Bates and he had a mother who was played by my queen Vera, and there was a motel and he was killing some people, I think. I don't remember.
This is amazing. It's actually perfect. Like, I'm so happy that you've forgotten most of it because that means I get to, like, really tell this and you get to feel it for the first time. And
exactly. And the only other thing I know, and I don't even, this isn't even a no, I've been on the Universal Backlot tour many a time and seen the house in the motel outdoor set.
I would die. You have such a love for backlots. And if we ever find ourselves in LA together, I so badly want to experience
that. I will take you to every single one of them.
I'm so down. So I chose Psycho for our first episode because, first off, like I said, it's my number three of all time. I can't wait any longer to tell this story. Mm-hmm. But also, it's one of the three horror movies in my entire life that has left the type of impact on me where I'm genuinely spooked going to sleep that night.
Ooh.
I have thick skin when it comes to horror. I can watch like this craziest shit right before bed and be completely fine. But there's a specific point that really freaked me out that I'll explain when we get there. But yeah, at 24 years old, I was inspecting every corner of my house before going to bed. I also thought it would be cool to cover a movie that's considered a first of its time for our first episode. Psycho is commonly referred to as the first slasher, which technically it isn't at all. But it's definitely the most influential slasher that went on to define what the genre is today. Oh, also, Caitlin has a horror movie reaction channel. She's scared.
Sure do.
And I feel like there's some pressure there for you to watch Psycho. Like, I bet it's one of those where people are like, what about this? But I honestly feel like it could be a really fun choice for like a little campfire story retelling versus a reaction. So
yeah, no, especially because with old horror, sometimes like it doesn't hit the same way it would had you watched it when it came out. So especially with the older films, I'm down to hear that story and then go and watch it.
Yeah, there's some effects that are definitely dated in this movie. And for some people, like, it just takes them out of it. For me, it doesn't. Like, I'm like one of those annoying cinephiles that is like, oh, it's so good for its time. It didn't take me out of it at all. Like, I can look past it. But there were definitely moments where I was like writing out this recap today where I was like, oh, let me make that sound cooler than it was. So to get into a little bit of background first, this movie is based on the book Psycho.
It was a book?
Yes.
Okay, this is already new.
It was released in 1959, and then the movie came out in 1960.
Wow.
Really quick turnaround.
That's like 2025 behavior.
Yeah. So it was Robert Bloch's 9th novel of 30 novels that he would write. 16 of his books have been adapted into movies or TV series, with Psycho being the first one.
Wow.
I haven't looked into like any of his other stuff, but honestly, I'm so down to look into that because I love Psycho so much. But the Psycho novel was a hit and had already been pitched to Paramount Studios and rejected when Alfred Hitchcock, the director, Alfred Hitchcock's assistant, Peggy Robertson, read a positive review of the book in the New York Times and brought it to his attention. And then Hitchcock at the time was in contract with Paramount and ended up buying the rights to the book for $9,500. And then he ordered his assistant to buy as many of these books as she could to like stop people from reading them because he wanted to preserve the surprises for the movie.
Interesting.
And then he went and pitched it to Paramount himself and they were still like, no, like they gave a lot of pushback because for the time, this is really dark and hard to like transfer to screen in a safe way for like their standards at the time. They actually said that it was too repulsive for adaptation, which is so funny looking back on what it is today.
Right? What would they do today if they turned on the TV? I don't know.
Exactly. They'd be shaken in their boots. But, you know, eventually they gave in and Psycho was a go. So let's get into the recap. I'm so excited.
Let's do it!
We open in Phoenix, Arizona, Friday, December 11th, 2:43 p.m. Very specific, but that's what's on screen. The movie is black and white, but that's only because Paramount didn't give Hitchcock his usual budget. And since they really didn't want this movie to be made in the first place, they like cut costs and gave up the Technicolor. I think it was also because of like some of the things that were seen on camera were less, I guess, atrocious to them in black and white versus color.
That makes sense. YouTube lets me put more blood on screen if it's in black and white. So,
oh my God, interesting. That's a great hack for me.
Yeah.
The camera creeps into a window of a hotel room where we see Marion Crane and Sam Loomis, aka where Billy Loomis got his name. It's a little homage moment.
Oh my God.
Yeah, we meet Marion Crane, Sam Loomis. They're getting dressed after a lunch break hookup, and 1960s audiences are already clutching their pearls.
Yeah.
Marion is sitting there on a bed in her bra.
No.
They're probably like in their late 20s, early 30s. She does also have a little skirt like slip on. But yeah, the whole naked women sexual content horror trope, we probably have this movie to thank for setting that into motion. I know. I will say, I think that in this case, and a lot of cases where horror started to get more provocative throughout like the 60s and 70s, it was more because they were going with the shock value that comes along with the nature of horror. So it makes sense at the time. Once we start hitting the 80s, 90s, and the sexual content continues just to become a staple that wasn't at all about the shock of it, I don't really see the appeal. Like, it's unnecessary most of the time.
It sure is.
This movie, it was the first of its kind in that respect, for sure. Not only is it scandalous that she's in her bra, but also we find out that they are engaging in sexual activities together. And they're not married yet. Hence the secretive, I know, scandalous, the secretive hotel lunch break rendezvous. That's what that's about.
Oh.
It actually seems to be a point of contention in their relationship, which is long distance. He's in Fairvale, California, and she is in Phoenix, Arizona, which is an 11-hour drive. So he's like taking a plane to come and visit her when he can. She doesn't feel good about having to meet up in secret and tells him that this is the last time, hinting at wanting to wait until they're properly married to like engage in this activity again.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of shrugs off her hints and says that he'll be able to come back to visit next week, even if it's just to talk and get lunch or something. And she agrees that that would be okay, saying, oh, we can see each other. We can even have dinner, but respectively in my house with my mother's picture on the mantle and my sister helping me broil a big steak for three. And he responds to that with, and after the steak, we'll send your sister to the movies and turn your mother's picture to the wall.
Okay.
He is kidding, but like, also, he's kind of not, you know?
Right. Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean.
However, he does get serious and he says he's okay with it, that he wants to continue seeing her, even if it means abstaining for now. So he's clearly frustrated at the same time with having to wait, but he's like happy that she's at least willing to be with him. Unlike some other people in his life, he's got some issues. He says, I'm tired of sweating for people who aren't there. I sweat to pay off my father's debts and he's in his grave. I sweat to pay my ex-wife's alimony and she's living on the other side of the world somewhere. She reminds him that this is hard right now for her too, but she doesn't care about his financial situation. She just wants to get married now. Like he's all about, I need to have a certain amount of money before I can marry you. And she's like, I don't care. I just love you.
That's nice.
It is nice. He gets sarcastic about it and he's like, yeah, and live with me in a storeroom behind a hardware store in Fairvale. Tell you what, when I send my ex-wife her alimony, you can lick the stamps. So he's not happy with how his life is right now.
Apparently not.
Marion responds wholeheartedly though, I'll lick the stamps. She's all in. She's in love.
She's down.
But he's just not into it. It's clear that he doesn't want to get married until he's paid everything off and he feels like he can just start fresh. He seems to come to the realization through this conversation that maybe he's not the right guy for her and he'd understand if she wanted to cut this off and find a man who's actually available for something serious. And she says, I'm thinking of it. But like, they share a playful look that basically says they're both, you know, like not ending this anytime soon.
Okay, good, 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 good.
Marion hurries back to work. She works as a secretary at a real estate office, and she's been out longer than she should, but thankfully her boss, Mr. Lowry, is taking a long lunch with a client who wants to buy a home for his newlywed daughter. Her fellow secretary, Caroline, played by Pat Hitchcock, Alfred Hitchcock's daughter, I think she was like randomly featured in a lot of his stuff. Her coworker can tell that Marion is frazzled and asks if she has a headache or needs an aspirin. And then she says, I've got something, not aspirin. My mother's doctor gave them to me the day of my wedding. Teddy was furious when he found out I'd taken tranquilizers.
Oh.
I don't know what that was about.
Just some casual tranquilizers, you know.
Marion just lets that information sit in silence for a second and then keeps it moving and asks if there was any important calls while she was away. Caroline tells her that Marion's sister called to say that she's going to Tucson to do some buying and she'll be gone the whole weekend. That is when Mr. Lowry arrives back at work, his client Tom Cassidy still with him. The meeting went well, the sale is a go, and Mr. Lowry asks Marion to get the copies of the deed ready for Mr. Cassidy. Mr. Cassidy's kind of weird. Kind of smarmy. He shows Marion a picture of his 18-year-old daughter that'll be married the next day and says that she's never had an unhappy day in her life, which like, are you sure about that? But
yeah, you know, girls just want to have fun, right?
We're always happy all the time. Smiles mm-hmm. and smiles. But he goes on saying to Marion, you know what I do about unhappiness? I buy it off. Are you unhappy? There's an uncomfortable energy here of him like trying to entice her to let him be her sugar daddy or something.
Yeah, right.
But Marion's like, I'm good. So
I'm all right.
For real. He then pulls out the $40,000 cash that he's using to pay Mr. Lowry today for the house, bragging that he never carries more money than he can afford to lose. Even Mr. Lowry is uncomfortable with Mr. Cassidy wanting this to be an all-cash transaction, probably especially so because Cassidy admitted that it's dirty money of his that the government isn't aware of.
Oh.
Yeah. But Cassidy is insistent, and once he's in Lowry's office, Lowry says to Marion, I don't even want it in the office over the weekend. put it in the safe deposit box in the bank, and we'll get him to give a check on Monday instead. Because I think he's like kind of drunk. So they're like, maybe we can hold his money for him and then figure this out. Yeah, on Monday. Right. So Marianne gathers up the deeds that Lowry requested, brings them to his office, then explains that she'd like to go straight home after her trip to the bank due to her headache. And Lowry agrees that that's fine. So she heads off for the bank. Except when we cut to the next scene, Marianne is at home packing a suitcase and the $40,000 is on her bed. Yeah. By the look on her face, you can tell that she doesn't feel great about this. She's feeling guilty, but it's clear that she's just desperate to marry Sam and start a life together. And with this money, they can finally do that. She's driving in her car. We hear Sam's voice in her head. This movie does that a lot where like you can hear what people are thinking in their heads, but it's like the voices of others. They're spiraling, thinking about what other people are might be thinking.
Gotcha.
So she's thinking about how excited Sam will hopefully be when she shows up in Fairvale with the money. But then at a red light, her boss, Mr. Lowry, passes by her on the crosswalk and he sees her. And he seems a bit confused because she should be home by now and she's probably not driving in the direction that the bank is.
Uh-oh.
But he brushes it off and just like continues walking on his way. Okay. This is when like the paranoia really mounts in Marianne. She drives all night long and eventually she pulls over to the side of a pretty desolate road to get some sleep because it's been so long. In the morning, a police officer sees her car on the side of the road and goes to check on her. She's still sleeping, laying across the front seats, and he wakes her up tapping on the window. And she panics and immediately sits up, starting the car, but obviously is not just going to let her drive off without a conversation.
Yeah.
So she rolls down her window, and this is the story she decides to go with.
Oh, boy.
I didn't intend to sleep so long. I almost had an accident last night from sleepiness, so I decided to pull over.
Okay. Yeah, that works.
He kind of scolds her for sleeping in her car all night instead of finding a nearby motel. But she's like, yeah, okay, sir. Have I broken any laws? No. Yeah. So can I go? Like, she's really short with him.
Okay. You know what? Go, queen.
I mean, she's stressed about that $40,000 in her purse, like if he starts to search.
That's fair.
The officer picks up on the fact that something is off with her because she's acting weird. So he asks to see her license and checks her license plate just to make sure that it's actually her car.
Mm-hmm.
It is. So that's it. She's on her way again. And the music while she's driving, the music in the whole movie, but while she's driving is so good. Like you can feel that building paranoia in the soundtrack.
Ooh, okay.
She's tense because the officer seems to be following her for like a good chunk of time. But eventually he gets off on an exit. She calms down again. She makes it to Bakersfield, California. So she's about 7 hours into her 11-hour drive.
Okay.
Good progress.
That's not too bad.
She pulls into a car dealership and she asks the car salesman if she can trade her car in for another because she's afraid now of being tracked down by the police if they discover that she has stolen any money. The car salesman's response is, I forgot about this. He says, do anything you have a mind to. Being a woman, you will. Apparently, this has been interpreted as a female empowerment type of thing, like encouraging her that she's capable of anything as a woman. But like, I don't know if I take it that way. So they're talking and she makes it clear that she's in a bit of a hurry when she notices a cop, a different cop, not the same one, but a cop parked across the street, standing outside, leaning against his car and seemingly just watching her. So she pressures the car salesman to be quick about the transaction and he's hesitant because she's acting super sketchy.
Yeah, fair enough.
Who wants to buy a car this fast?
Honestly, me. If I could go to the car dealership and be out of there in 5 minutes, I would love that.
You might have a point. They might be, they're over suspicious, honestly. Let us get out of here. So they go inside and handle all the necessary paperwork, which she has. So he just goes with it. He kind of was like expecting her not to have what he needed, but she's legit.
She knows what she's doing.
While they're in the dealership, the officer across the street gets in his car and actually pulls into the dealership parking lot.
Oh, no.
Marianne sees him. I have to start that one over. Marianne sees him when she leaves the building and heads over to her new car. She's freaked out and almost drives off without them transferring her luggage from her old car into the new one. But as soon as that is settled, she rips out of there, leaving the car dealership employees and the officers staring after her just like, that was weird.
I don't know if I'm supposed to be rooting for this woman, but like I am. I really am. I'm excited for her. I'm like, get out of there. Get away from those cops. I'm really rooting for her right now, even though she stole that money.
I honestly, I love that. I love the honesty. And I think I agree. She's a nice woman. Just,
yeah, she just stole some money. Whatever.
I figured out like the conversion of what that is worth in today's like money. It's somewhere in the recap. So we'll get to that. It's a crazy amount of money.
Yeah, I mean, if I had $40,000 right now, I'd be freaking excited.
Yeah, I would be stressed having $40,000 cash
in my pocket.
So I don't know why the officer had an eye on her in the first place. I'm sure you could argue that he wasn't actually there, honestly, and she's just becoming super paranoid and his presence at all was like in her head to some extent. Or maybe the officer from before like did end up making surrounding counties aware of her license plate to keep an eye on her. I don't know. So the next scene is noted as like a pretty iconic one. It's another extremely long shot of like her driving and the camera is centered on her face and she's hearing voices in her head again of like the people in her life. But this time she's not hearing Sam's excitement to see her and like all happy about the money. She imagines a conversation between the car salesman and the officer back there, growing suspicious about her and what she might be up to. She imagines her coworker and boss realizing that she's missing when Monday morning comes around. Mm-hmm. And then her sister finding out and worrying about her and her boss realizing that his employee of 10 years has run off with, oh, here's the number of what it's worth today.
Oh, dear God.
$426,000.
It's
rough.
Oh, girly, she just snatched that.
She went for it. Mr. Cassidy accusing her of flirting with him and planning her getaway from the moment she saw the money in his hands. You know, it's all like building up what people are going to think and what's going to happen. And she's scared she's going to get caught. It's a whole thing.
And that's on anxiety.
Marion has this kind of gleam in her eyes and like a small smile on her face as her thoughts continue to spiral. I think because time is passing and she's realizing that she's getting away with it. And she wasn't a fan. She wasn't a fan of Mr. Cassidy. So she's happy to be the one in power now, having pulled one over on him.
Yes, queen.
Oh, and he's not going to want to report this because it's dirty money. So he'd like, exactly. So he'd get himself in a lot of trouble. I feel like if she didn't know that, she probably wouldn't have gone for it.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
Okay.
It starts to rain pretty hard and the downpour gets so bad that she's having a hard time seeing the road. So eventually when she sees a sign flashing on the side of the road that says Bates Motel.
Oh no, no.
She decides to pull in. She heads into the motel office, but there's no one in there. She does see though that on a hill behind the motel is a beautiful, creepy Victorian home. There's a light shining from one of the windows, and she sees a woman walk by it inside the house. So she gets back into her car, honks the horn to hopefully get someone to come down and help her book a room.
Yes.
A man quickly comes down from the house with an umbrella, very apologetic about not hearing her over the rain and being down here to help right away. They head into the main office, and she asks if they have any vacancies, to which he replies, 12 cabins, 12 vacancies. They moved away the main highway.
So nobody's there.
Nobody's there.
Okay, that's fine. That's fine.
No, wait, pause, because like, would you find that an alarming thing where you'd be like, oh, I don't want to stay here anymore just because it's completely vacant?
No. I think it's just context right now because I probably would be like, that's fine.
I'd probably be like a little spooked, but I'd be like, oh, I'm in my head about it. It's going to be fine.
Exactly. Exactly.
Ugh. So he seems pretty calm and chipper about it, acknowledging that even though he doesn't get much business and she clearly ended up here by accident because of the storm, that it's no big deal. And sometimes you just got to roll with the punches. He's a chill guy. He's super chill.
I'm sure.
He hands her a sign-in sheet where she's supposed to write her name and address or just her hometown. So she uses an alias and writes down Marie Samuels.
Good on her.
Exactly. Smart. And then says that she's from Los Angeles instead of from Phoenix.
Okay.
Meanwhile, Norman, we find out his name is, seems to be having some trouble in choosing which cabin key to pick out for her. At first, he goes for cabin 3, but then he hesitates and eventually decides to choose cabin 1. And he explains, cabin 1, it's closer in case you want anything. It's right next to the office.
Wait, I remembered something.
Oh my God, tell me.
No, there's like, okay, wait, no, hold on. I might be wrong, and this might not even be in the movie, but in the show, I want to say there was like a painting on the wall in the office or something, and he like takes it down and there's a hole in the wall.
Oh my God. That's so crazy. I wonder what might happen.
No!
Okay. She doesn't really care what cabin she's in, but does admit to being kind of hungry. And he mentions a spot nearby saying there's a big diner about 10 miles up the road just outside of Fairvale. She had no idea she was this close to Fairvale. Like, she's literally 15 miles away from Sam right now. But the storm is so bad and Norman quickly insists on just grabbing her bags from the car, getting her settled into the cabin. And she's still going to stay the night, even though she knows, you know, how close she is.
Oh, girly.
He fills her in on the room, boasting about the soft mattress, hangers in the closet, Bates Motel branded stationery in case she wants to, quote, make her friends back home feel envious. He's got...
Yeah.
He jokes. He jokes awkwardly, but he jokes. And then there's this kind of weird moment where he points out the bathroom. But when he does, he just like quickly turns on the light inside and says, and the, over there.
Oh.
It's like he seems a bit uncomfortable acknowledging the bathroom, or at least the word. She has to like fill in the blank for him and is like, the bathroom? And he says, yeah, well, if you want anything, just tap on the wall and I'll be in my office. She's like, thank you, Mr. Bates. He goes, Norman Bates. So that's where she learns his first name. And I think he insists that she just call him Norman.
Okay.
There's a couple beats of silence where they just look at each other a bit fondly, actually. Like there's a vibe.
Ooh,
There's like a catch of romance even.
Oh.
And he asks if she's really going to drive up to the diner and she says no. So he invites her to eat with him. And he says, would you do me a favor? Would you have dinner with me? I was just about to myself, you know, nothing special, just sandwiches and milk. But I'd like it very much if you'd come up to the house.
Okay. Listen. All right. I'm not saying I don't know. At this point, I would not be feeling so hot about going to the house to have dinner.
I wouldn't.
Like, not only is it creepy, but also I'm just too socially awkward for that. So, like, no, yes. Thank you.
It's already a nightmare. Even if you're the most normal person in the world, I'm not normal enough to just casually have a dinner with a stranger.
Absolutely. You could be, like, an old, frail grandma, and I'm still like, how am I going to make conversation?
Yeah.
I can't do this. You could kill me all you want, but don't make me have a conversation with you.
That's amazing. He just keeps rambling and rambling, and it's actually it's like the charming kind of awkward that a person can have. He has a kind, oh my God. So Anthony Perkins is who plays Norman Bates. He's incredible.
Yeah.
He has this like kind smile and soft eyes, but also he has this like stiff, awkward body language paired with it. It's actually endearing.
It's interesting that I don't know what he looks like.
Oh my gosh.
Never seen what Norman Bates looks like. Right now, I'm loving him being my imagination.
Yes. So anyways, she agrees and he leaves her to get ready, saying that he'll be back for her when the food is all set. As soon as he's gone, she digs around in her things, grabs the envelope of cash and starts looking for a good spot someplace around the room that she can keep it hidden. But everywhere just seems too obvious. So
under the mattress.
No, that's actually... why not? That's smart. So what she does is a choice, but I can see it working. But under the mattress is so much better than this, in my opinion. She grabs the newspaper from her purse and that she picked up at the dealership that morning and transfers the money out of the envelope, folding it into the newspaper. And then she just places the newspaper on the bedside table.
That stresses me out.
I get the whole hidden in plain sight concept, but like, I don't know. That it stresses me out too.
I don't know. I mean, I also don't walk around with $40,000, so I don't know what it's like. I've never had to do this.
And just as she's doing that, she hears yelling coming up from the house. It sounds like an older woman, and we hear, quote, no, I tell you no, I won't have you bringing strange young girls in for supper. In candlelight, I suppose, in the cheap erotic fashion of young men with cheap erotic minds.
Oh.
We hear Norman respond pleadingly, mother, please. But she keeps going off on him and says, and then what? After supper? Music? Whispers? Odd. Like,
uncomfortable. Mom, calm down.
Exactly.
What's with the helicopter parenting of a grown man?
Oh my God, right. He's got to be minimum 30, I would guess. I think everyone's like in their 30s. But yeah, super weird that she just jumps to that conclusion and
very
that
strange.
She has such a problem with it. Even if he did want to have like a woman over.
Exactly.
The argument goes on. Norman insisting that Marion is just a stranded stranger who's hungry, but his mom keeps being weird about it, insisting that they're basically going to end up doing unspeakable things with each other that disgust her. She won't allow Marion to eat their food and tells Norman to tell her that, following it up with, "Or do I have to tell her? Because you don't have the guts. Huh, boy? You have the guts, boy?" Like, what's going on?
Okay, low-key poor Norman. Jeez.
Yes, absolutely. Like, you're Marion and you're like, this poor guy, what kind of mother is that?
Right?
Norman actually finally cracks, screaming at her, "Shut up, shut up." Like, he is over his mom being a helicopter parent.
Deserved.
A couple moments later, Marion sees Norman leaving the house and heading back down to her with a tray of food in his hands. So she waits for him outside her room, and when he sees her, there's some awkward energy because they both know that she heard the argument that just took place because it was so freaking loud. She acknowledges it, saying, "I've caused some trouble." And he responds, "No, mother, my mother. What is the phrase? She isn't quite herself today." So he's defending her.
Okay.
And says that he wishes he could apologize for other people. He just feels really bad. So Marion keeps up the polite nature between them and insists that they just enjoy the supper he managed to bring down. She takes a step aside to let him into her motel room, but he gets weird and awkward about it and says he'd rather have dinner together in the office next door.
Okay.
Yeah, I would take that as like a good sign. Like, oh, like, yeah, that's really, that's polite, like, to make me feel more comfortable.
Respectful.
So she heads in there with him. There's a little parlor attached to the office that he takes her to, and inside she notices that there's a fair amount of stuffed birds decorating the walls.
Oh.
Kind of creepy, more so in context, but, you know, people do that.
They do, and I consider it creepy no matter the context, but yes.
Agreed. Not a taxidermy fan.
Me neither.
He offers her to sit, and she thanks him again for how kind he's been. The tray of food he brought down is all for her, so I guess he's just, like, planning to sit there and watch her eat. He probably did it because his mom told him not to. Yeah. So he doesn't want her to know that exactly. He's bringing, you know. When she takes her first bite, he laughs a little to himself and says, "You eat like a bird."
Wait, like the dead birds on your wall, bro? Exactly. Hold up.
You can't be saying that right now.
No.
She glances around again at all of his taxidermied birds. And she says, "You'd know, of course." Mm-hmm. And she is being polite about it. There's not like a weird energy here.
She's not being polite about that. I'm sorry.
Yes, Marion isn't judging. He goes, "Not really." Like, he doesn't really know. Anyway, I hear the expression "eats like a bird" is really a falsity. And then he stumbles on that last word, something he seems to snap in and out of a lot. Like, he keeps stuttering.
Okay.
I have to say, it adds to the endearing qualities that he has, the stutter.
I can imagine.
It's weird though, because sometimes he's really effortless and like elegant with his speech, and then he'll randomly stutter and seem to lose his train of thought in the middle of talking.
Okay.
It's a really interesting performance. Anyways, he goes on to tell her that apparently birds eat a lot, and she's just sitting there like, okay. And then,
okay, sir.
And then he says, "But I don't really know anything about birds. My hobby is stuffing things."
No, sir? Dude, listen, that's not a way to talk to a lady.
I'm trying to eat. What do you mean that you like stuffing things? What's happening? He overexplains his hobby, saying that he can't handle stuffing animals outside of birds, that birds are the only ones that really look good when they're stuffed because they're such passive creatures compared to dogs or whatever else. And she's still just sitting there trying not to judge, but she eventually responds with, "That's a strange hobby." He is not offended. He seems to completely understand her statement as fact and adds to it, saying, "Uncommon too." So he's like, yeah, it's strange and uncommon.
Yeah.
Valid.
Yeah, sir.
He goes deeper into his taxidermy hobby with her, saying it's more than just a hobby with him. It doesn't just pass his time, it fills it. And she's like, oh, you really have that much spare time.
Get him.
He quickly disagrees, saying, talking about all the upkeep he does for the motel, running errands for his mother, only the ones that she decides he's actually capable of doing. He says that, like, he kind of digs at her a little with that one.
Okay, yeah.
Marion's like, yeah, that's great, but do you go out with friends? Like, do you have a social life outside of your mom and, like, your motel? he gets quiet. And I just have to say, side note, this scene is probably my favorite scene of like the whole movie, this conversation.
Okay.
It's like so, like acting wise, it's peak Anthony Perkins playing Norman Bates. It's so interesting. One moment you're like, you're a creep. And then the next moment you're like, you're cute. Like, it's so strange.
Oh, I like complexities like that. That's fun.
Yes. So he gets quiet and contemplative over the question and then says, well, a boy's best friend is his mother.
Sometimes.
Sometimes it can be.
I don't hear that a lot. That's all.
Also, I want to say, like, his response to that specific question is almost like, I don't need friends because I have my mother. And it's like, well,
no.
Is that healthy? Then he steers the conversation away from being about him and focuses more on her, asking where she's going and inquires further when he gets the idea that she's running away from something.
A man that asks questions? That's actually pretty impressive. Sorry.
Wait, so I'm looking at it as he's just trying to deflect, but honestly, in the moment, as myself, I'd be like, wow, he really wants to know things about
me. He wants to get to know me. This is amazing.
He cares. But when her guard goes up, wondering why he would think such a thing, like, because he was insinuating that she's running away from something,
mm-hmm.
he just brushes off his comment, deciding instead that people actually never run from anything, explaining, quote, we're all in our own private traps, clamped in them, and none of us can ever get out. We scratch and claw, but only at the air, only at each other.
Oh.
exactly. Ah. Marion humors the conversation, saying, sometimes we deliberately step into those traps, to which he says, I was born in mine. I don't mind it anymore. It's lovely dinner talk. Lovely.
That's not dark at all or anything.
That strikes a chord for Marion, taking some pity on Norman, and she begs him that he actually should mind it. Like, she feels bad that he just has accepted whatever fate he's in now.
Right.
He laughs a little at that with a shrug and says, oh, I do, but I say that I don't. He is so cute.
Like, yeah, maybe he is.
He's so charming. It's the delivery, too. Like, I cannot emphasize enough. He's just like, oh, well, I do mind, but I just pretend I don't. Like, it's no big deal, though. It's like, oh, I wanna hug you. Like, I get
know.
It.
Group hug. Let's go.
I would want nothing more than to be his friend right now if I was Marion. I can't lie.
Yeah.
The bird thing, the stuffing hobby, we can maybe fix that. But yeah, he has these moments where just it gets so vulnerable and you just can't help it. Then he stops his like shy smiling when Marion decides to bring up his mother directly, saying that she'd hate to be talked to the way that she heard his mom talking to him. And he gets so serious and dark and says, sometimes when she talks to me like that, I feel like I'd like to go up there and curse her and leave her forever. Or at least defy her. But I know I can't. She's ill. Marion's a little bit confused by this because based on the yelling she heard from all the way down here, she sounded pretty strong and healthy.
Mm.
He says she misunderstands him and he means ill in a different kind of way. And he says, quote, she had to raise me all by herself after my father died. I was only 5 and it must have been quite a strain for her. A few years ago, mother met this man and he talked her into building this motel. He could have talked her into anything. And when he died too, it was just too great a shock for her. And the way he died. And then he breaks out of his like dark, serious tone and into an easy smile saying,
ew. It's
probably, exactly. He's like, no biggie. Saying it's probably not something he should talk about while she's eating. So I guess he does have a boundary.
Okay. I'm intrigued by this other dude though. Cause why the motel? Like that's weird.
Yeah, so he skips over the details and wraps it up by explaining that after the last man's passing, it was just too hard for her, his mom, and she was left with nothing. And Marion is like, she has you.
Mm-hmm.
And he counters that with, a son is a poor substitute for a lover.
A weird thing to say, but that's
it's
okay.
A weird thing. It's almost like he wishes he could, like,
yeah,
be
no,
her
like,
lover.
I don't like their relationship. It doesn't make me feel good.
No, it's uncomfortable.
It feels icky.
There's like a weird sexual undertone.
There is. Even like the mom being your best friend thing, obviously that can be totally fine. But in this context, it's just starting to feel creepy.
Yep. Marion's really concerned for Norman at this point and tries to urge him to get away from her for a while. But he says he could never do that. Not in her state. Quote, she'd be alone up there. The fire would go out. It'd be cold and damp like a grave. If you love someone, you don't do that to them, even if you hate them. So I find this line really interesting because he acknowledges the dynamic of loving and hating a person at the same time. but he seems to realize how that sounds, and he further explains, "You understand, I don't hate her. I hate what she's become. I hate the illness."
Okay.
Marion is still trying her best to help and come up with solutions for all of this, so she offers, "Wouldn't it be better if you put her someplace?" And she trails off, like, not wanting to say it out loud.
Yeah.
And Norman gets dark again, leaning forward and looking offended, and he says, "You mean an institution? A madhouse?" He scoffs to himself as her silence confirms that that's what she meant.
Right.
And he continues, "People always call a madhouse someplace. Put her in someplace." Marion's uncomfortable with the switch in tone, and for the first time seems genuinely spooked by his demeanor at this mm-hmm. point, like starting to feel unsafe.
Fair.
She apologizes, and he's spiraling a bit about the idea of a madhouse, scolding Marion about the idea and saying she's clearly never seen what it's like in there. And he says, quote, "with the laughing and the tears and the cruel eyes studying you," basically implying that he's been in one.
Oh, yeah, right.
He's so passionate about, like, a madhouse, quote, and what it's like in there and how he could never send his mom there. Like, how do you know
sir? That? Exactly.
And he snaps back into some soft laughter.
Good.
At the thought of his mother having to live in one of those. He doesn't think it's necessary because at the end of the day, she's harmless. He says, "as harmless as one of those stuffed birds." Marion is stiff with another apology, not really sure what else she can say at this point, insisting that she meant well with the suggestion. Norman doesn't have much empathy with her explanation. He says, "People always mean well. They cluck their thick tongues and shake their heads and suggest oh so very delicately."
They cluck their thick tongues? That's what they do?
He's a poet, okay?
No, he's not. I don't like that.
He's coming off as disgusted with her and honestly just people in general. Marion is terrified. She's just sitting there frozen, and maybe Norman notices because he relaxes back in his chair, calming down, changes his tone again to something more understanding. And he says, "Of course, I've suggested it myself." Wait, pause. "Of course, I've suggested it myself, sending my mother to a madhouse, but I'm sitting here and, like, saying how dare you to you."
Yeah, what are you... Bro, I can't... You know what? I can't keep up with Mr. Norman Bates anymore. I don't know what his issue is, but, well, it's probably not good. Given the context, but damn, sir.
So back and forth. And then he continues, "but I hate to even think about it. She needs me. It's not as if she were a maniac. She just goes a little mad sometimes. We all go a little mad sometimes."
Wait, is that where that comes from?
Yes, it's the quote. Oh, you probably didn't know like the name of the actor. So like in Scream, when Billy switches, sorry, like Scream spoiler. This is a spoiler podcast. He goes, "Anthony, we all go a little mad sometimes. Anthony Perkins, Psycho." Like he quotes, that's what he says. He's talking about the actor.
Oh, I love making connections.
I know, it's fun.
Oh my God.
I cannot even begin to explain his face during this entire scene, but especially this moment when he says that.
Yeah.
Anthony Perkins, the facial expressions are next level. They're perfect. He's managing here to be like righteously insistent and serious and on the edge of darkness about what he's trying to get across to Marion. And then after delivering that line, he just huffs out an airy smile and brings back his warm, kind eyes and makes you feel like you can be at ease again. And he asks Marion, "haven't you?" Like asking her, "haven't you gone a little mad ever?"
Well, actually.
So Marion agrees with a yes. And I think at this point, she's just trying to go along with whatever he wants to hear.
Yeah.
And she stands ready to get the hell out of there. But he's all like, "you're not going back to your room already." And she says she's tired and she's going to have a long drive back to Phoenix tomorrow, you know. And she says, "I stepped into a private trap back there and I'd like to go back and try to pull myself out of it." So she tells him the truth that she's actually from Phoenix, not from LA, and that she genuinely is planning now to go back to Phoenix and like give the money back. Like she's regretting it now. She regrets doing it and she wants to go return the money.
Uh-huh.
Facing the consequences.
Right.
He tries to get her to stay a little longer just to talk, but that is the last thing my girl Marion wants to do. So she makes sure to say she'd like to, but and as soon as he hears the but from her, he puts a hand up and is understanding and is like, "yeah, no big deal."
Okay.
He says he'll see her in the morning and make sure to bring her breakfast. and she says she'll be up and ready to go right at dawn, but he agrees that he'll still be there to see her off with some food, like no matter how early she gets up, which is like,
see, I want my girlie to get in her car right now.
Yeah.
I just want her to go get in a car.
I think I would at that point. I would leave. I don't care about the rain.
It sounds like it, based on like this back and forth creepy demeanor. And nobody else is there.
That's the thing. Like, if there were other people there and I had this experience, I'd probably just be like, oh, I can't wait to get out of here. But like that conversation mixed with no one else being here, I think I would leave.
Exactly.
With that agreed upon, he closes out the conversation by saying, all right, Miss, unsure of her last name, and like waits for her to fill in the blank. And she does. She says Crane. And when she walks back to her cabin, he goes and checks that sign-in sheet, seeing that it's not the same last name that she wrote down when she checked in.
Oh, girl.
So she was honest with him again, this time with like giving her actual last name.
Right.
And when he sees that, he just smiles to himself a little before turning back into the parlor, shutting the door behind him. I think he's smiling because he's like, oh, I caught her on a lie.
I know Norm is not a good dude. Like, I know this. So I'm like, is he like happy that like that's evidence of her not being there?
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, he definitely could be thinking ahead too. So then he stands at the adjoining wall, the wall that's shared with Marion's room.
No.
And just and just listens closely to what's going on in there. We just hear some shuffling. She's walking around, whatever. And then he removes one of the paintings on the wall to reveal a peephole that he has made. And he looks through and watches Marion. She's undressing down to her bra and like that slip skirt.
Yeah.
Puts on a robe and walks out of his view again. Norman gets a little bit dark again in the eyes, and he places the painting back over the peephole. And with an air of determination, he heads back up to his house.
Ew.
In his house. He's about to go upstairs, but decides against it and instead goes and just sits at the table in the kitchen. Back in the motel cabin number one, Marion is writing down some calculations on a piece of paper regarding the stolen money, keeping track of what she's spent and what she has left. Once she's got her answer, she rips up the piece of paper and heads to the bathroom, tossing the scraps in the toilet and flushing them away, which is another random iconic shot from the movie. Like, it's the first time a flushing toilet was captured for film. And broadcasted for scandalized audiences.
Ooh, not a toilet.
After that is taken care of, she closes the bathroom door and slips out of her clothes and gets in the shower. She's scrubbing away at her body with her hands and non-existent soap when we see the shadow of the bathroom door opening up.
No, thank you.
The silhouette of a woman with her hair pulled back into a bun and a blouse buttoned tight up her neck comes closer and closer to the clear shower liner. And then she pulls the liner open, raises your classic gigantic kitchen knife. Marion turns and screams in shock. She gets stabbed about a dozen times. We see her blood mixing with the water and swirling down the drain. Before she's even fallen to the tub floor, the woman hastily leaves.
Wait, what? Hold on.
Woman.
My brain. What do you mean, woman?
I said woman, and that is what I mean.
Oh my God. Okay. Also, that was casual.
Yeah, it really just happens.
Damn.
Everything is fine, and then it just is happening. Marion grabs for the shower liner, but she's dying, and she falls half out of the tub, taking the liner with her, and that is the end for Marion.
No, I thought, she is gone already?
Dead. This was a big shock to audiences because Janet Leigh, who plays Marion, was a huge name.
Oh.
Promo showed her as the star of the movie right alongside Anthony Perkins. But now, like, we're 45 minutes in with an hour left and all bets are off. Anyone can die. It's very much also probably where Scream decided to heighten that. With that opening scene there. I wonder, because Marion has like a blonde bob. I wonder if they chose that for like Casey in Scream as an homage.
It had to be intentional because Scream's all about that kind of thing. So it
goes so meta with its horror.
Exactly.
The camera pans out of the bathroom and through the cabin window to the house. And we hear Norman scream, mother, oh God, mother, blood, blood. He's just screaming and freaking out, like presumably seeing his mother return to the house covered in Marianne's blood. He goes running out of the house and down the steps toward the motel, and he makes it to the bathroom. But when he sees Marianne's dead body, he stops and turns around shaking and covering his mouth like he can't even handle seeing all that blood. But he pulls himself together. He goes and retrieves a mop and a bucket from his office and gets to work on cleaning up what his mother has clearly done. He uses the shower linen to wrap up Marianne's body. He scrubs down the whole bathroom. He stuffs Marianne and all of her belongings into the trunk of her car, including the newspaper that is stuffed with cash.
Forgot about that.
He just grabbed the newspaper and didn't realize what was in there. And then he drives the car over into this marshland next to the motel and pushes the entire car into like a swamp. Ooh. And we watch it sink completely under to the bottom. And once that car is out of sight, Norman smiles a little and it seems to have eased his anxiety for now.
See, I'm feeling things because there's a part of me that feels a potential for split personality situation. But then I'm thinking about if you hear the woman's voice earlier on, like the mother, I'm like, okay, maybe not, but I don't know. I'm intrigued by this.
We cut to Sam Loomis, poor Marion's now ex-boyfriend, I guess. He is in the back room of his hardware store in Fairvale, and he's writing a letter to Marianne basically saying that he doesn't care about their lack of money anymore, and he just wants to be with her, and inviting her to come live with him and officially be together.
Too late, bestie!
Then a woman shows up in the store with a suitcase in hand looking for Sam. She introduces herself as Marianne's sister, Lila, and she's very distressed, asking if Marianne has been here with him. The way she's looking at Sam makes it clear that she's suspicious of him. But he's like, no, she hasn't been here. What's wrong? Lila explains that Marianne left town on Friday. It's, I think, Sunday afternoon now. You just kind of have to guess and pay attention. She hasn't heard from her since. Sam is getting stressed now, realizing something's wrong, and is asking Lila for more details on this whole situation. And then this man in a fedora hat that was standing outside the hardware store staring in at them just walks in and says, let's all talk about Marianne, shall we? We're like, hello?
Sir, can we help you?
This guy introduces himself as Arbogast, and he's a private investigator.
Arbogast, what a name.
Quite a name. He has been hired by Mr. Cassidy, who wants his $40,000 back.
Oh, true that.
Mm-hmm. So that whole mess gets explained to Sam, and obviously by the sound of it, Arbogast and Lila are both putting two and two together, thinking that he's hiding Marianne and the $40,000 and that they've got plans to run off into the sunset.
Right.
Arbogast is determined to find her, and so he goes around to every motel, hotel, bed and breakfast in and around Fairvale, and he ends up at Bates Motel.
No. Okay.
Norman is sitting on the porch of his office when Arbogast pulls up, and they exchange polite pleasantries and small talk, but eventually they get down to business, and Norman asks what brings him here, realizing he's not looking to book a room. Arbogast explains that he's a private investigator looking for a missing woman, and he pulls out a picture of her, holding it out and asking, has she stopped here recently? And Norman doesn't even look at the picture. He just keeps eye contact with Arbogast and says, well, no one stopped here for a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Arbogast insists that he still look at the picture, so he does, and casually shrugs it off, saying, no, like, don't recognize her. Arbogast pushes the conversation forward, though, saying that her real name is Marianne Crane, but she might have registered under an alias.
Uh-huh.
And Norman admits that, you know, he doesn't really bother with registering guests anymore due to the lack of business these days, and he's just been doing this so long. It's just a formality that he's dropped over the years.
Yeah.
And speaking of formalities, that reminds him, he flips a light switch behind the desk, which causes the Bates Motel sign to light up. And he says, we had a couple last week who said if the thing hadn't been on, they would have thought this place was an old deserted. And Arbogast cuts him off, still polite, but he says, oh, see, you had a couple here last week. Before, you said that it's been weeks since anybody's come by. So he's like, it's easy to forget these things. Do you mind if I look at your registration book?
Uh-oh.
Norman hands it over, still relaxed and acting like it's no big deal and he's not going to find anything. But you really see Norman break into his first sweat when Arbogast says he has a handwriting sample of Marianne's and pulls that out.
Oh, no.
And of course, he finds a match in the registration under Marie Samuels.
Oh.
So he asks Norman if this woman seemed to be in disguise. Like, he just pushes on, like, doesn't push Norman, like, why did you lie? He just is like...
Yeah, that's weird. Like, I that's kind of the biggest red flag yet to me.
I think he's just trying to, like, keep it calm and casual to try to get more information, like, not grill him too hard.
That's fair, that's fair.
Norman's just kind of freaking out at this point, not sure what to say, so Arbogast offers for him to check the picture of her again in case he just needs a refresher, and Norman is almost shaking, insisting, I wasn't lying to you, sir. Like, he gets ahead of it. Like, he knows he was caught in a lie, and he's like, I wasn't lying, even though he hasn't even been called out on it. But Arbogast blows off Norman's worries, like, none of this is a big deal, and is like, oh, I know that. I know you wouldn't lie. And Norman smiles a little at that and just insists that time flies and he got mixed up. And then when he looks at the picture again, he's like, oh, right, her.
Oh, yeah. Would you look at that?
She was here.
Oh my God, I just remembered.
So Arbogast asks him to tell him about her. Norman just says she arrived late one night. It was raining a lot. She went to bed straight away and left early the next morning. Arbogast starts to grill him a little bit about the timing of all of this, and Norman is stuttering his answers, explaining that it was really early Sunday morning that she left. The grilling continues, and it looks like Norman is consciously trying to put on a more, like, laid-back demeanor now, saying she didn't come here with anyone or meet anyone, and no phone calls were made. But when Arbogast asks, did you spend the night with her? Norman becomes serious and almost looks scared, insisting no, like, they didn't. And Arbogast follows it up with, well, then how did you know she didn't make any phone calls?
Mm-hmm. Dude, there's only two ways this ends. Either Arbogast is dead or Norman gets caught, because if you're a true PI, like, you know what just is happening right now.
Honestly, props to Arbogast. I feel like he's doing a good job. He's getting good info. But, like, also, we know, like, we're scared of Norman Bates and this whole situation of whatever's happening at this creepy motel.
Uh-huh.
And so it's like, oh, shoot. Arbogast, if you push too much, watch
out. I know.
Out.
Be careful, buddy.
So Norman pauses at that, scrambling to figure out how to respond. And he says, well, she was very tired. And see, now I'm starting to remember it. I'm making a mental picture of it in my mind.
Sounds like a second grader, like, yes, trying to tell their teacher, like, why their homework is not with them.
So that's such a good call out. He's very childish at points.
Yeah.
The stuttering just keeps getting worse as he starts to explain this mental picture that's suddenly forming.
Okay.
He says, she was sitting back there. No, standing back there with a sandwich in her hand. And she said she had to go to sleep early because she had a long drive ahead of her. Arbogast is like, yeah, that's cool, but, like, standing back where? Like, what are you talking about?
Mm-hmm.
And Norman explains that he's talking about his parlor attached to the lobby that they're in, and that she was very hungry, so he made her a sandwich.
Yeah, and he just forgot all of this happened.
This is literally, like, two nights ago, I think.
Now it's all coming back.
A few more questions back and forth, and the conversation dies out a little bit, so Norman's like, all right, well, I got stuff to do, so you can probably go now. But...
excuses him. Yes. That's amazing. Yes.
But Arbogast just lays it all out there and is like, yeah, I don't know about that. Something just isn't adding up. And he straight up asks, she isn't still here, is she? Norman says no. And then he starts laughing like that would just be hilarious and crazy. But Arbogast is like, yeah, I suppose I need a warrant to check all the cabins. And Norman is like, oh, that's fine. You can come with me while I change out all the sheets and you can have a look around. That's totally fine.
Okay.
So they walk out of the check-in lobby and Norman heads down the porch one way while Arbogast goes the other way to get a look at the house on the hill. But he notices when he looks back at Norman that when Norman walks up to cabin one, he pauses and just skips and goes to cabin two.
Oh.
Which, like, that's not suspicious at all, Norman.
Norman, buddy.
When Norman finds or, like, notices that Arbogast isn't right behind him, he laughs and is like, oh, did you change your mind? And then he goes, you know, I think I must have one of those faces you just can't help believing. At this point, Arbogast isn't bothered by Norman's weird behavior and comments and just asks if anyone is home, because obviously he's thinking now, like, maybe Marion's hiding out in the main house.
Right.
Norman immediately says no, like, immediately. He's like, no, no one's home. And Arbogast is like, that's so funny because I just saw someone sitting up in the window. Norman's like, no, there isn't. And Arbogast is like, yeah, there is. Like, take a look. You'll see there's someone sitting up there right now. So finally, Norman is like, oh, that must be my mother.
Oh my God, I'm gonna kill him, bro. He's like really irritating me right now. You just gotta find a story. You gotta stick to it. You can't jump or frown. Yes. You gotta stay as close to the truth as possible. I'm not a criminal, but I think I'd be better at it than Norman Bates.
It's like, obviously something is going on here. It kind of is insinuated that this isn't the first time something like this has happened around here. And it's like, do you not have more experience with this? Because he's acting very inexperienced, like, and frazzled by all of this.
Yeah.
So he's like, yeah, that's probably my mom. And he says, quote, she's an invalid, which I believe is like super not okay to call someone these days. Mm. And he says, it's practically like living alone, basically saying you there's no use talking to her. Like, you can't get anything out of her. But his attitude, he just keeps digging himself into a deeper hole. And Arbogast prods again and says, if Marion were here, you wouldn't be hiding her, would you? Norman says, no, not if she paid you well. Norman starts laughing again, like, haha, that's so funny. No, he was just stuttering away. And now he's like, haha, easy breezy. Nah.
Yeah, right.
And he can't stop laughing. Like, he just keeps laughing. Arbogast tries to get through to him, saying, if this woman were to ask you to gallantly protect her, you'd know that you were being used. You wouldn't be made a fool of, would you? Something switches inside Norman at that suggestion, like he's offended, and he becomes pretty angry, saying, but I'm not a fool, and I'm not capable of being fooled, not even by a woman. Arbogast is like, damn, I didn't mean to like offend your manhood. But Norman... But Norman keeps going with his foot in his mouth syndrome and says, quote, mm-hmm. Let's put it this way. She might have fooled me, but she didn't fool my mother.
What?
Sir.
What do you? So bad at this.
So bad. So obviously Arbogast is like, so she met your mother.
Yeah, right.
Well, I'd like to talk to her.
Yeah, exactly.
Norman puts his guard up immediately, saying that's not going to happen due to his mother's condition. Arbogast keeps pushing, probably feeling like he's finally putting some pieces together here, but Norman shuts it all down, basically tells him it's time for him to leave.
No.
So Arbogast leaves.
No, he doesn't. Literally. He leaves. Okay, wait, but you're telling me he's like, oh, she might have fooled me, but she didn't fool my mother. Oh, but my mother, you can't even get a word out of her. So What is it? Does she know what's up or does she not know what's up, Norman?
Two different stories in the same sentence.
Oh, bro, he's killing me. And if Arbogast doesn't get his little butt back here with some backup, I'd be really upset about it.
So Arbogast leaves and Norman watches him with like a really dark look. But when Arbogast's car lights finally disappear and he's officially gone, Norman laughs to himself again. Like, that was silly.
Yeah, just some giggles. It's fine.
Cut to Arbogast on the side of the road at a phone booth. He went straight to the nearest one that he could find after leaving the motel, and he calls the hardware store. Lila and Sam are still there together, just on standby with everything that's going on. He fills Lila specifically in on everything that he just discovered, and he's saying how he's suspicious about this motel and thinks Marion was with the motel owner's mother. But he's weirdly not allowed to speak with her. There's some good news because he doesn't think Sam is aware of Marion's situation. Like, he's less suspicious of Sam now. He just tells Lila that he's going to go back to the motel to do more digging.
Good.
And then he'll be back out to them in about an hour.
Well, I bet.
Will he? So he pulls up back at Bates Motel and we see Norman walking along the porch of cabins and kind of disappearing into the shadows at the end. Not the end closer to the house, like he's walking away from the house and down the cabins. So Arbogast doesn't see him when he pulls up in his car and gets out, and he heads straight into the office calling out for Norman, which I'm surprised. Like, I thought he was just going to be sneaky sneak and like try to get
like, what are you doing?
But I don't know what his angle is here. Like, hey, I really do need to speak to your mom, sir. I don't know.
Yeah,
but
he's coming back like 20 minutes later and everything's just fine now.
Yeah. So Norman's not there. So he steps into the parlor and is a little freaked out when he sees all the stuffed birds everywhere.
Mood.
He heads back outside onto the cabin porch. Still no one around, so he just decides to head up to the house. He doesn't even knock. He just walks right in there, as you
listen, do. Listen, in most cases, I would be like, no, 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 no. But in this case, I'm like, yes, let's go.
Honestly, true. That it is, it's become a bit of a trope in horror where it's like, oh my God, can you please knock? Like, don't just walk into these people's houses. But given the situation, you can't fault him too much.
Right.
He heads up the stairs because he knows, like, he saw that outline of the woman sitting in the upstairs window.
Yeah,
and he
figures,
you know, his mom must be up there.
I have seen that image because they kind of play with that on the back lot of Universal. They do have a silhouette of a woman like sitting in the window upstairs.
Oh, nice. I love that.
Yeah.
He makes it to the top of the landing, but he doesn't get a chance to speak with Mrs. Bates because she comes storming out of a room upstairs with her knife raised and doesn't hesitate stabbing him. Arbogast falls down the stairs. She follows him and then stabs him multiple times again at the foot of the stairs and to death. He's dead.
Oh, Arbogast. Bessie.
So cut to Sam and Lila sitting around together, waiting for Arbogast to get back and fill them in again. They're starting to get worried because Arbogast said he'd be back in an hour and it's been 3 hours now. Lila insists that they go out to the motel and see what's going on, but Sam is trying not to get too worked up. Lila's about to go on her own, and that's when Sam is like, okay, I'll go and you stay here in case he comes back. She doesn't love the idea, but she listens. So Sam goes out to the motel and finds that Arbogast isn't there. So Sam just goes back to the hardware store, worried now, just like Lila is. He tells her all he saw was a woman in the window of the house, but no one answered. And Sam suggests that they go see Al Chambers, who is the town's deputy sheriff.
Mm.
So Lila and Sam go right to Deputy Chambers' home, and it's pretty late. He and his wife are in their pajamas, but they fill them in on everything that has gone down. And they end their back and forth explanation of everything with Lila expressing concern over the fact that Arbogast said he was going back to the motel just so he could have a quick conversation with Norman's mother. And now it's been so long, and she just thinks that something's wrong.
Right. Yeah. No, actually, I'm here for this. This is smart.
Yes. Yeah. It's really satisfying when we get like police involved in horror.
It so is. Oh my God. And then when the police experience it and don't just dismiss them, it's a whole new level.
Deputy Chambers agrees, saying, well, I think there's something wrong too, miss. I think what's wrong is your private detective. I think he got himself a hot lead as to where your sister was going, probably from Norman Bates, and called you to keep you still while he took off after her and the money. So he's suspicious of our PI.
Okay, now I'm feeling less excited.
It's a possible theory, but not one that you should deliver as, like, fact, you know?
No, not at all.
Sam and Lila are like, yeah, no, I don't think so. Deputy Chambers' wife suggests that maybe they should call Norman to help get everything cleared up. But Deputy Chambers doesn't want to bother him in the middle of the night. You know, we're polite.
Yeah, that's what your job is, to be polite.
Sam insists it wouldn't do any good anyway, because when he stopped by there just a couple minutes ago, there was no answer and he seemed to be out. But Deputy Chambers is like, nah, he's definitely home. He just doesn't answer the door. He's the town hermit. I think he literally says that. And then he says, you must remember that bad business out there about 10 years ago. And Lila is like, yeah, I couldn't care less. Please just call Norman. So
yeah.
Norman answers.
Oh.
And he answers Deputy Chambers' questions, saying that a private detective, Arbogast, did drop by tonight, got some information on Marion, and then left. Mm. And that's the end of it. Deputy Chambers relays the conversation to Sam and Lila, and Lila's just getting more confused and concerned, asking, wait, so he didn't go back and he didn't speak to the mom? Like, what?
Mm-hmm.
And Chambers goes, your detective told you he couldn't come right back because he was going to question Norman Bates' mother, right? Well, Norman Bates' mother has been dead and buried in Greenlawn Cemetery for the past 10 years. So,
hold up. Wait a second. What do you mean? You liar or something? I don't know.
Honestly, me in this moment watching this, I'm like, did Norman and her fake her death for some reason? Did Norman replace her with another mom?
Oh, yeah.
Is this officer just wrong and something's going on with him and he is weird? Like,
yeah.
so much. Apparently, it was the only case of a murder-suicide in Fairvale's history. Mrs. Bates poisoned a man that she was seeing, the man, that last man, poisoned a man that she was seeing when she found out that he was married, and then poisoned herself.
Oh. So this is the man that Norman had been talking about earlier, about saying, like, I'm not going to tell you. Oh, because she was eating.
Norman found them dead together in bed.
Ew.
Yeah. Sam calls bull on this story because he saw Mrs. Bates through the window himself, and he believes that Arbogast had to have seen her too. And it's just too much of a coincidence for them both to be spotting Mrs. Bates. Deputy Chambers just says, well, if the woman up there is Mrs. Bates, who's that woman buried out in Greenlawn Cemetery?
My brain is doing so much thinking right now. I'm like sitting here like, hold up. Because like part of me still is like, it's just Norman. But based on the timelines, now obviously these aren't exact timelines because we're telling a story. It doesn't seem like he could be in two places at once, but maybe he could be. Mm. I don't know.
We cut to Norman leaving the motel office and returning back up to the house. He goes up the stairs and turns to enter a room on the left side of the landing, the same room that Mrs. Bates came out of before to murder Arbogast. And Norman talks to her, saying, now, Mother, I'm going to bring something up. She cuts him off with a laugh, like a really high, spooky, shrill laugh, and tells him how ludicrous he looks trying to give her orders.
So there is a woman in there. What the
fuck? Yes. Yeah.
What?
He says, please, Mother. She says, no, I will not hide in the fruit cellar. You think I'm fruity, huh?
She's fruity? Well, this is some tea.
We stan.
We stan a fruity queen.
I'm staying right here. This is my room and no one will drag me out of it. Least of all, my big, bold son. Norman pleads with her and says, they'll come now, Mother. He came after the girl, and now someone will come after him. Mother, please. It's just for a few days. Just for a few days so they won't find you. Mrs. Bates continues to refuse, remembering the last time, apparently, that he forced her to hide down in the fruit cellar. But Norman defies her and literally scoops her up into his arms and carries her out of the room and down the steps. And the whole way, she's just screaming for him to put her down, but he doesn't.
Ew.
The next morning, Lila and Sam are determined to go check out the motel themselves together this time. On the drive over, they make a plan. Lila suggests that they register as regular guests, pretending to be man and wife, and then they'll search every inch of the place behind Norman's back.
Okay, I love that.
Yeah, it's a decent plan. When they pull up at the motel, Norman comes down and greets them. He's got his charming, polite demeanor going for him again, and he's happy to assign them cabin 10. Doesn't bother to have them register, which Sam calls out, and he says that he's paying for it through his company, so he's technically on a business trip, and he insists on registering so that he can have a notarized receipt. Norman complies, they sign in and take notice of the room that Marion stayed in, which was cabin 1.
Right.
They continue off to their assigned cabin, and Norman watches them go with equal suspicion of them as they have of him, you know.
Okay, fair.
In their room, Lila insists they head over and search cabin 1 right away. She went ahead of the men out of the office. Like when they were finishing up check-in, she went out and quickly checked the lock on cabin 1 and it's unlocked.
Oh.
So she wants to take advantage of that.
Yeah.
Lila is hyped up about Norman, theorizing that he was desperate for cash due to his dying business, did something to Marion and took the money.
Fair.
That's exactly where my head would go to.
Yeah, it's a fair theory.
So that's her theory. She wants to find some proof. So they head over to cabin 1 to begin their search. When they make it to the bathroom, Sam points out that it's odd that there's no shower curtain. Mm-hmm. And Lila finds a piece of torn up paper that didn't get washed down the toilet drain. And it shows numbers being subtracted from 40,000.
Oh, yeah.
So she's hoping this could prove that Norman found out about the money, but it's still not much even to prove that.
Mm-hmm.
So next on Lila's to-do list is to go and talk to Mrs. Bates because she believes that she told Arbogast something that got him into some trouble.
Right.
So now the plan is that Sam is going to find Norman and keep him occupied while Lila sneaks into the house to talk to his mother.
Dangerous, I now know, but still I'm like, yeah, let's go.
Us as the audience are like, oh, good luck, guys.
Yeah.
Sam finds Norman in the office and they start to make small talk. The small talk turns into a little bit of a grilling, but Norman stays cool.
Mm.
Meanwhile, Lila is up in the house and she has made it up the stairs. She makes it to Mrs. Bates's bedroom. but it's empty. She notices that the bed is indented with the shape of a body, like curled up to sleep. So she knows that like someone was recently in here.
Right.
Back with Sam and Norman, Sam is basically accusing him of stealing money to get away from this dump. And Norman is just confused and offended, insisting that he wants nothing more than to just stay right here where he is and run this motel. He says, he's like, I have a sentimental attachment to this place. I grew up here. I had a happy childhood, which, did you?
Well, that sounds like you sure did.
Back to Lila. She's now searching another room. It's another bedroom.
Okay.
This one is covered in child's toys.
Ooh.
Dolls, stuffed bunnies, and a twin bed.
Okay.
There's a record player on a small table in the corner that currently has Beethoven in it. And on a bookshelf, she grabs a book and it's bound like a normal book, but it doesn't have a title or an author on it. Like it's just a blank binding.
Okay, yeah.
And she looks kind of like shocked and disgusted when she opens the book, but we don't see what's in there.
Oh, no.
When I first watched this, I thought it must have been a diary, but I looked it up just to make sure. And this is probably pornography because back in the day, that's how it would get sold in books and they would just not have anything on the cover to be discreet.
Interesting. I thought it was like a, I don't know, some kind of murder book.
Yeah, that's where my head went. I was like, there's gotta be evidence in here.
Right.
Back to Sam and Norman. Norman isn't doing too hot. He's breaking a sweat, fidgeting, stuttering. Sam is saying, I've been talking about your mother, about your motel. How are you going to do it? And Norman asks, do what? And Sam keeps pushing the narrative and is like, buy a new one, like a new motel in a new town where you don't have to hide your mother. And Norman's pissed and tells him to leave. But Sam doesn't stop. He calls out the $40,000 directly. Norman is screaming for him to shut up. And he walks into his parlor. Sam follows him and continues. And he says, I bet your mother knows where the money is and what you did to get it. I think she'll tell us.
Oh, God.
Something dawns on Norman. And he begins to really panic. And he asks, where's that girl you came here with?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's realizing what's going on here and that right. they're probably trying to get information from his mom. So he's like, oh, shoot.
Yep.
He tries to get past Sam, but Sam blocks him. And Norman grabs a nearby vase and knocks Sam out before running up to the house. So Sam isn't dead, but he's knocked out.
He's knocked out and our poor girlie is.
Yeah, Norman's come in.
Yeah.
Lila is coming down from upstairs and sees Norman running toward the front porch through the window.
Creepy.
So she quickly runs down into the basement as Norman comes crashing in and he immediately goes upstairs.
Wait, the basement. Oh boy.
We love a basement. In the back of the basement, Lila finds the door to the fruit cellar.
No.
Inside, there's a woman sitting on a chair facing toward the wall, almost like she's
No.
Yes. Like she's like in a corner, like on timeout right now.
Oh my God. That is one of my least favorite things in horror is like somebody just staring at a wall, like up against it.
It's so funny because it's like not that creepy when you just say it, but like it is.
No, like they do it in The Visit too.
I immediately think Blair Witch. So Lila's relieved though, because, you know, she's looking for Mrs. Bates. So she's like, oh, cool, Mrs. Bates. She walks up to her and taps her on the shoulder. And Mrs. Bates swivels around at her, revealing that what is actually in the chair is a fully decomposed skeletal corpse.
Sorry, what?
It's a corpse.
Wait, okay.
It's a corpse dressed up, like wig and all.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, that's normal.
It's fruit cellar things.
It's a corpse.
So Lila screams, as you do.
Yeah, no, I that's justified.
And then we hear someone running down the basement steps. And when I tell you this performance freaked me the fuck out.
Oh, dear.
It's Norman. And he is wearing one of his mother's dresses and a woman's wig.
It was you. It was you. It was you. You split personality situation.
The movie does so good at like making you believe it couldn't be because of the voice
and the
you literally see the body that you think is alive, like walking around, but you never really see the face, which I didn't think as suspicious because I thought it was just like a style choice to make like build up tension and make her creepier.
That's normal.
And like when he carried her out of the bedroom, so when they were having a conversation about him being like, I need to bring you down to the fruit cellar, that was like you heard them talking, but it was just a shot of the staircase and you couldn't see them talking to each other in the bedroom. But then he carries her out and it's a legit body. So I'm like, oh, and then you hear her talking, hear her screaming, but both right. of them are faced away from the camera, just walking down the stairs.
So is he both voices as well?
Yeah.
Ew, no, I yeah. hate that. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it.
So
no, no.
He is holding up a big knife and on his face is just like pure unrestrained glee.
Ooh.
The type of smile where your mouth is as open as possible while you're smiling.
Ew, gross.
Yeah, it's scary. Lila is in shock, just like at the image of what she's seeing.
Valid.
And Norman starts to go after her, but Sam comes rushing in and grabs him from behind.
Hey, Sam.
And he manages to get the knife away and restrain Norman.
Whoa.
And Norman is just like contorting and his mouth is wide open like he should be screaming, but there's no sound coming out. It's wild.
Ew.
We cut from there to the county courthouse.
Oh, cool.
Mm-hmm. Sam and Lila are there and then a bunch of people in suits are there.
Oh, like a time cut.
Yeah. And Norman is shut away in a room speaking to a psychiatrist.
Oh.
The psychiatrist comes out and he's about to give like this big monologue, basically explaining to us, the audience, what the fuck just happened. So he says, I got the whole story, but not from Norman. I got it from his mother. Norman Bates no longer exists. He only half existed to begin with. And now the other half has taken over. He breaks the news about the murders and suggests that they check out the swamp behind the motel. There are probably more bodies than just the two recent murders. So back to understanding Norman's psyche, the psychiatrist explains that you have to go back 10 years to the time when Norman killed his mother and her lover. He had already been dangerously disturbed, had been since his father died when he was like really little. His mother was a clinging, demanding woman, and for years the two of them lived like there was no one else in the world. Then she met a man, and it seemed to Norman that she threw him over for this man.
The jealousy.
Yes, that pushed him over the line and he killed them both. And then he explains that basically what Norman had done was too awful for him to process, so he erased the crime from his mind. He stole her corpse and a weighted coffin was buried.
Nobody.
Oh my god, he treated the body to prevent it from smelling, aka like his stuffing
stop
preservation hobby with the birds.
No.
That's how he kept like his mom preserved.
That's disgusting, bro.
And he initially kept her in the fruit cellar, like from the start, but that wasn't enough. So he began to speak and live for her, take on her persona so that he could go on pretending in his mind that she was still alive.
Yeah.
He often lived as both personalities, but sometimes the mother half took over completely. Quote, because he was so pathologically jealous of her, he assumed that she was just as jealous of him. Therefore, if he felt a strong attraction to any other woman, the mother side of him would go wild, which is
right.
what led to like Marion. After the murder, Norman would wake up as if from a deep sleep and like a dutiful son cover up all traces of the crime that he was convinced that his mother had committed.
Right.
There are some insensitive comments like with outdated terms referring to the trans community because of the fact that he would dress like his mother.
Oh, yeah. I can see that.
But what I think makes like this section of the movie really groundbreaking and just like the whole setup in general is that for the first time in the mainstream, they put motive and background into the antagonist and went inside the mind of the killer, which is so common to do now.
Yeah, for sure.
Before Psycho, it was like really sci-fi horror and creature features, like literal monsters that were running the show in horror.
Absolutely.
But Psycho really opened up the slasher genre and like psychological motive in a really big way. So I do want to say though that when talking about things like this, there's always technically some other movie that did it first.
Yes.
I'm like talking about like the legacy that this one specifically
absolutely
left behind.
It's like calling Blair Witch the first found footage film. You know, it's debated, but you know, there's reasons why things get a certain title.
It's the found footage film that put the subgenre in the mainstream.
Right.
So yeah, I get that. Anyways, the psychiatrist believes that Norman's dominant personality has won out and now he is permanently his own mother in his head. An officer knocks on the room that we're in and asks if he can bring Norman a blanket because Norman says that he's a little chilly.
He's a little chilly. He needs a blankie.
The murdering got him a little chilly. He gets the go-ahead, and we follow the officer down the hall and we see him disappear into Norman's detainment room. And we hear Norman say thank you in his mother's voice.
Ew.
And then we cut to Norman alone in his room after the officer leaves, draping the blanket over himself, getting nice and cozy. And the camera slowly closes in on his face as we hear his thoughts. Also, his mother's voice.
Right, yeah.
And this is what he says, or she says. Sad when a mother has to speak the words that condemn her own son, but I couldn't allow them to believe that I would commit the murder. They'll put him away now, as I should have years ago. He was always bad, and in the end, he intended to tell them that I killed those girls and that man, as if I could do anything except just sit and stare, like one of his stuffed birds. Oh, they know I can't even move a finger, and I won't. I'll just sit here and be quiet, just in case they do suspect me. They're probably watching me. Well, let them. Let them see what kind of person I am. He's his mom now, wow. Thinking that because we know that it was Norman and he has this mental disorder, but like he thinks he's just his mom now, and the mom thinks she got away with framing her son for murder since think it's Norman. It's so trippy.
So many layers to it.
And then we see a fly crawling around on his hand, and his thoughts continue. I'm not even going to swat that fly. I hope they're watching. They'll see. They'll see and they'll know and they'll say, why, she wouldn't even harm a fly. And Norman looks up with a smug smile, feeling like he, or rather Mrs. Bates, has gotten away with murder.
Uh-huh.
And as the scene cuts to the next, we see the face of Mrs. Bates's corpse like flash over Norman's smile.
Gross.
Yeah. And the movie ends with Marion's car being pulled out of the swamp and like a classic The End on the screen.
Yeah.
And that is that.
Wow. Wow. What a film.
I have to say, part of like why it spooked me so much, I think, was just because Anthony Perkins is incredible.
Yeah.
But also, I have to say, I do live alone. I watch this movie alone at night. And I have an old house with a creepy basement and a fruit cellar in my basement.
No, you do not.
I didn't like it. I like legit had to check the fruit cellar for like 3 days after this.
I don't blame you for that. Something that it's like really interesting to me at this moment is thinking about the TV show.
Yeah. Now,
the funny thing is I never watched the last episode. I don't know why. I just didn't watch it. Like, I got busy and I never watched it. And I'm trying to remember because, like, logically in my brain, I would think the show would end with Norman killing his mother. I do not remember Vera ever not being in the show. Mm. So I'm wondering if that was the final episode.
It
or
must
if
have been.
It happened before that and I just don't remember because, again, so much of that show is erased from my brain at this point because it's been years. But I'm just curious, like, if that's part of the show or not.
Yeah, is that like 5 seasons? It went down for a decent amount of time.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly how long it was.
I looked into it because I had no idea like when it took place. Like when you told me that you didn't really remember much from the show or what you did remember, I was like, oh, perfect. Like, this is fine.
Yeah.
But I looked it up and I had no idea that this was a prequel, like the show was.
Right.
So I was like, oh, yeah, we should be fine. But that would be interesting if it ended on, because if the mother was actually alive through the whole show, I would expect, that she probably gets got in that last episode. You might want to like think about it for a second, but I went into this knowing my personal survivability score.
Yeah, I gotta think.
So 0% is 0% chance of survival. 100% is 100% chance of survival.
Okay.
I put mine at 62%.
Okay. So you're on the more surviving. Okay.
I think I'm just so not trusting of people. Honestly, if I was a kid of the 1960s when this came out, this would probably be a different score. But like the person I am today is very modern about being aware of who I trust.
Yeah.
And Norman kind of gives you the chance to get out. It's not like he's determined to kill. It like almost overcomes him and he's genuine with his politeness, but there's just something off and like he can't,
right?
You know, so I feel like given the amount of time and chances he gives you to leave, I would probably take that chance, but it's not 100% either because I also admit to like being charmed by Norman and I could see myself just thinking I'm crazy and it's no big deal. So I just went with 62.
All right. This is making me kind of have to face some of my bad traits because I'm feeling closer to like a 43% on this. And I think like you, I would be suspicious and not trusting, but I'm also a people pleaser. And I could see myself not wanting to cause trouble, even though I'm suspicious. So I'm just going to wait it out till the morning and leave when I said I was going to, because that's what I said I was going to do. And I don't want to switch up now. So I would like to believe that I would be smart and leave, but I could also, like, I don't like awkward situations. So me avoiding an awkward situation of having to bring up this person that I'm actually going to leave a little earlier than I said I was, unfortunately for me, might get me killed. And now I got to rethink my life a little. Because I would like to have a higher survivability score for Norman Bates here. Because like you said, there's so many opportunities to get away.
Yeah, there are. That's interesting. The 62 and 43. Wait, let me do the math. What does that give the episode? 62 plus 43 divided by 2 is 52.5. We're going to round up whenever it gets into decimals. So 53% is our combined survivability score.
I'm so sorry for bringing that down. It should be higher.
No, I love it. One thing I'm really excited about actually with the survivability score aspect is us having complete different opinions. I think that's so fun.
And I'm realizing with this one, there's going to be a lot of interesting places to like dig into as to why. Before we did this, I was thinking like with like a movie like Halloween, it's like 100%.
Right.
Like
he's so slow.
He's like my reasoning would be he's too slow.
I'd be on a plane. I'd just move.
Exactly. But like with this one, it's just like a whole different thing, which is really interesting.
Yeah. We want you guys too listening to tell us what you think your survivability score for the episode is. We have an Instagram.
The thing is, I don't even know what it's going to be yet. I haven't made it.
Yeah, we right now as we're recording, we're going to have an Instagram and it should be up and we'll probably have a post dedicated to like this episode.
Yes, absolutely.
One thing I'm just like sad about podcasts is like there's no comment section. So
Right? I've thought about that.
I just wonder who people will side with more, like in the lower half or upper half for this one.
Yeah, right.
I'm curious about that.
I'm suspecting upper half for sure.
Really? I could totally see it both ways.
Because I think my reasoning is really dumb. But I'm just being honest. I'm just too awkward.
I for sure would like, once he was gone to get me food, that's when I would just rip out of there and never see him again. You know what I mean? I would be awkward too in trying to be like, I'm going to go now.
Yeah.
So I probably would try to just leave without him noticing.
And I respect that. But my brain is like, I leave when he's gone. And then that's going to be the moment I think about when I'm trying to fall asleep at night. Like when he came back, like, did he think I was the rudest person all time? Because he was probably fine, right? And I was really rude.
No, true. Because there's, with him specifically, there's always, until you're literally being murdered, there's always going to be that idea in your head of like, oh, he's just an awkward guy. Like he's just kind of weird. And that's fine.
Exactly.
So like, I probably would also though think about that, like, oh, what if I just tore out of there and I'm being ridiculous and like, he was just a normal dude. I'm so excited for our next episode. It is also heavy on the psychological aspects and very interesting to play some What Would You Do?
Ooh, I'm excited.
Yeah, I'm so excited for the next episode. But this was so much fun.
I love this.
Thank you guys so much for listening. And we will see you next week with another scary movie.